Welcome to our Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Welcome back, everyone. This is Brian Lau from Duke University. And today I have the privilege of doing the second part of our series here with Dr. Jaswari and Owen Hurley, two members of the Anterior Shoulder Instability International Consensus Group, to talk about their three-part consensus statements in anterior shoulder instability that was published in the Arthroscopy Journal. Last time we spoke a little bit about the diagnosis, history and exam, and the arthroscopic band card and different techniques. And today we're going to kind of focus on a little more advanced procedures, including the remplissage, ladder J, bone grafting, and then how are we deciding to return to play. So we'll start off with kind of, last time we talked a lot about bone loss, how we measure that on advanced imaging, whether it's 3D CT scans. But what about the humeral side? Owen, can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on measuring the humeral side, kind of track, and then how are you deciding on what procedure? Is there a certain percentage that you're looking for or something in the history and exam?
So I think this is something that we have known is important, but are starting to realize more and more as the glenoid track concept has kind of become mainstream and is something we get examined now on our in-training exam as residents. But I think the big thing about it is everyone, as I said in the last podcast, seems to kind of talk glenoid bone loss, humeral bone loss, but it's really about the two of them and how they interplay. If there's an off-track lesion, it's changed, by how much bone loss there is. The more bone loss there is, the more like glenoid bone loss that, the more likely there is to be an off-track lesion, by nature of how it works. And I think that interplay is important. There's a difference between 15% glenoid bone loss and no off-track lesion and 10% bone loss and an off-track lesion. And I think that's kind of the next main thing in research is delineating where do those cutoffs lie when they interplay with each other, not just in isolation. And I think people are becoming more and more aggressive in doing a remplissage. There's now good level one evidence showing it reduces the recurrence rate. There was that randomized control trial out of Peter McDonald's group, and subsequent large meta-analyses all show the same stuff, that it reduces the recurrence, and it's just trying to indicate that patient. So I think it's trying to find those patients who may not need something augmented on the glenoid side, but you're still worried enough that you're going to do something. And I think it's kind of probably now trying to find when should you not if there's a Hill Sachs. We know the complications with it are pretty low. It does pretty well. It reduces your recurrence. And I think it's definitely changed things in what people are doing and what I've seen going from New York, Dublin, Duke, and how people are treating things over the last few years.
Yeah, I think that we're finding more and more important. Like you said, it's a bipolar problem. And that's kind of dictating treatments. And Dr. Jaswari, for you, last time we talked about arthroscopic, but how are you using the humeral bone loss side? Is that helping decide a remplissage, or is there a role for open band card? I think the consensus that was an area of most discrepancy was between arthroscopic and open band cards, no bony procedures, but just arthroscopic or bony soft tissue procedures. And kind of how are you factoring the humeral side with that?
Yeah, so I think that's very important. I think certainly for me, I have a very low threshold when I'm doing an arthroscopic procedure, an arthroscopic band card. If there's any degree of Hill Sachs lesion, adding a remplissage, I think the data supports it. There's minimal downsides to doing it. And there seems to be a benefit of whether it's the actual filling in of the defect at the level of the Hill Sachs or adding of some capsular reduction, specifically posteriorly, there is a role because you're grabbing the capsule there, you're grabbing the infraspinatus, you're translating it into the defect. For certain, there's some degree of capsular volume reduction there. So for me, it's a no-brainer to add that to the procedure. And I think the problem is the controversy of deciding, well, when do you do an open procedure over something like a combination arthroscopic band card and remplissage? And for me, that has a lot to do with, one, is there any Hill Sachs to begin with on the patient? And are they young and a contact athlete? And I think for me, the more I look into this group of patients that has a higher failure rate with the arthroscopic technique, I get nervous, specifically in wrestlers who are younger, approaching them, or football players, approaching them via an open Bankart procedure, or open capsular shift procedure. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. And it has to do with comfort level, but that there was a discrepancy in the consensus. Where does that fit in? And for me personally, it fits in someone who has a Bankart, has instability, who's younger, who's a contact athlete, and doesn't have much of a Hill-Sachs. Now, how many of those patients do we see in the office that don't have some sort of Hill-Sachs procedure? It's low, right? You know, have some sort of Hill-Sachs lesion. It's lower. So for me, that's definitely a smaller percentage. So if they have a Hill-Sachs that's on the smaller side, and certainly have a Bankart, I'm approaching with an arthroscopic repair and the remplissage. For more of the contact athlete who's younger with a large Bankart, less of a Hill-Sachs, I may consider an open capsular shift on them, or an open Bankart.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Most patients do have a Hill-Sachs. And, you know, I had a patient, though, it looked like there was going to be just a really small Hill-Sachs. And, you know, when we got in there, it was actually even smaller than we anticipated. And we ended up converting to an open for that very reason, because I wanted to give her extra stability because she had so much instability. So I think that's where the role is. If somebody has a lot of instability, you're concerned that just with isolated arthroscopy, you probably added an remplissage, but the Hill-Sachs, for whatever reason, ends up being small or has you know, remodeled a little bit. So, but what's your technique for remplissage? How are you doing it? Are you doing putting anchors in before you start doing your labral part? Are you doing knotless or tying? How are you doing your remplissage?
Yeah, so I've transitioned. I think the first one is the standard, you know, traditional anchor technique. I'll insert them first. I'll use a 70-degree screw up in the front, looking, you know, towards the back. Insert the anchors, pass the sutures, don't tie them, switch to the put the scope back in the posterior portal, then address the anterior Bankart, repair that, and then back and tie the remplissage sutures at the end of the procedure. I think if you tie them early on, you can reduce some of the capsular volume. There are others who say where they'll tie them first and they feel like it brings the head back and it gives them more anterior exposure. For me, I've not had that experience. For me, I'll just pass the sutures, go back to the front, repair the Bankart, and then do the remplissage tying at the end. I've transitioned to using more of the knotless technique where I think you can get a greater reduction via and tensioning via these knotless all suture based anchors. So I think there's benefit to that. So I've transitioned to that, but the same thing, I won't tension them until the end of the procedure.
Gotcha. Yeah, but I think that's important. I think that it kind of closes down your space if you do it first. So I kind of,
yeah.
And then one of the really interesting questions you guys asked in the consensus, and Owen, this is what's going to be for you, is indications for a remplissage in isolation. You know, I thought that was a really unique question to ask, and kind of your take on that, how that was genocide, you know, came up with that, and kind of your takeaway from that question in the consensus.
Yeah, I guess we're kind of looking at that. I mean, we were thinking ahead and what the answer turned out to be. As something I've seen before, where going back, it's a failed Laterge or there's still recurrent instability, and doing a remplissage then without doing anything to address the front. And it's in those patients who you've done a well-placed Laterge, there's still recurrence, you know, how do you address it in kind of a minimally invasive manner without going back, reopening everything up, doing an inhibine? And it's in those patients who, you know, either they have a new worsened Hill-Sachs or it just wasn't addressed. I know there's that saying, you know, I've never met a Hill-Sachs lesion that wasn't on track after a Laterge, but, you know, there certainly are those patients who have severe bone loss. And I think this is targeting them specifically.
Yeah, so in a scenario where you've done the procedure in the front and maybe should have done something back, but didn't earlier? Is that
what? Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Yeah, I thought that was an interesting question because I haven't thought about that in isolation. But I don't know if Jess, do you have anything to add to that? Ramposajan isolation.
That's a great question. That certainly didn't come from my brain. It is one where I rarely see. And my concern is if you do have a patient like that who has a successfully healed anterior approach, the question is, well, they're still locking into that lesion. And it's a challenge for me how I'm going to approach that. Am I going to ignore the front? And I think a lot of it has to do based on the patient's history, their symptomatology. But if I truly feel that for example, the anterior lateral J has fully healed and it's strictly an isolated posterior, and in a case like this, it's going to be something much larger. And for me, something like that, when they approach that size, I'm not doing a ramplissage. I'm approaching it with some sort of open graft into the back to get some bone in there. Because those are the ones that I see. When I've had a lateral J that, it's extremely rare where they still have some sort of apprehension, the Hill-Sachs tends to be very large, and I'm approaching it with filling it in and with bone. For me, bipolar lesions and, for example, seizure patients, who have both a significant anterior glenoid bone loss and a large Hill-Sachs, someone like that, I'm approaching with a DTA from the front because their bone loss tends to be well closer to 30% on the glenoid. But when they have a large Hill-Sachs, if I'm going through the front, I'm going to try to address that back lesion, especially on a seizure patient who will stress whatever I do in the front. So again, large Hill-Sachs lesion is usually going to be in the case that Owen's talking about. And for me, it's more of a bony procedure than a soft tissue procedure.
Yep. I think that's revision surgeries and those posterior dislocations from seizure patients, those are very challenging cases. Kind of going back to more of the traditional ramplissage, arthroscopic, when you decided to ramplissage, are you counseling patients about loss of motion? I mean, that's there's some data say that maybe that's not much of a concern. But how do you counsel patients in terms of if you're gonna do the ramplissage and their motion?
Yeah, great question. For me, it doesn't come up. It's part of the capsular label, reduction in volume. So that to me, that's part of that procedure. So in terms of addressing their instability, I don't even bring it up in the sense that I tell them that you may have some minor motion loss reductions, but it's minor and you won't even be affected by it. And I have that same discussion, whether it's just the labor repair, plus or minus a ramplissage. So that comes up very little in isolation as the ramplissage procedure, reducing motion. I've not seen that in my practice, so it's not an issue.
Yeah, I think that some more of the recent data has shown that should be, it's less and less of a concern, if anything, maybe only 1 or 2 degrees, which I think, as you mentioned, most people won't even notice that. So. And then kind of moving on from the ramplissage, more bone loss. So when are you thinking about a lateral J? Now, we talked about in the last podcast a couple of different points in terms of not just using the numbers, but the history and exam. But what's your traditional classic indication for a lateral J, Dr. Jaswari?
Yeah, so greater than 15% bone loss on the glenoid, plus or minus some humeral head involvement or Hill-Sachs involvement, contact athlete, younger. So once they start getting to that 20% mark, I'm considering a lateral J, especially mid-range instability, lateral J. As it approaches 25, 30%, I start to get concerned about the ability of the lateral J to control the bone thickness, to control all the instability. And I start considering a DTA, distal tibial allograft procedure, where I can get a bigger piece of bone there. But I use measurements and I look at the thickness of the coracoid and I calculate all those in association with the bony thickness of the glenoid. And for the most part, even in certain patients with, approaching 25 to 30% bone loss, sometimes their coracoid is thick enough that I'm okay and they don't have much of a Hill-Sachs that I'll do a lateral J in those patients. But traditionally, as you get much higher bone loss on the glenoid, I want to reconstitute that with a distal tibial allograft, also restoring some of the cartilage. For lower degrees, you know, approaching more 20%, less than 25, I'm considering a ladder J.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I use a lot of similar logic in my own decision making in terms of when it gets higher up and whether or not that bone block from the coracoid can restore it is I'm uncertain of. But that brings up another point that came up in the consensus. Oh, no, this was kind of for you. It's like we talked about the area that had the least amount of consensus was the classic versus congruent arc technique for the ladder J, probably because of deciding how much bone loss you need. What's your take on that? And, you know, in terms of that with the consensus?
Yeah, I mean, I think what people said in the consensus was, you know, the classic technique may be better, but I think it kind of lacks maybe some of the nuance in, you know, individual patients. I think the thought behind the classic technique being better is you get more bone-to-bone fixation. There's more likely to get a bony union. You may not restore as much glenoid face with that as the congruent arc, and there's also some element of its curvature is more natural. I mean, I know you can burr it down a little bit after when you do the classic to match the natural curvature of the bone itself. I think the main thing is how much bone loss does the patient have? The congruent arc can restore much more, but do you need that in every patient? Probably not. As Dr. Jazrael mentioned earlier, you know, they tend to remodel back to whatever normal is over time. So I think in most patients, you know, if it doesn't exceed what can be restored with physiologically by using a classic arc, that's kind of where you may think congruent arc may be better, but there's really not a huge amount of evidence comparing the two. Most of it's out of the group in Buenos Aires, and they've said similar outcomes, both do about the same, both are pretty good, no major difference. But I think that's just getting into kind of the weeds of when you might think one or the other.
Yeah, and I think you bring up good points in terms of that. And for Dr. Dasrari, you know, we had talked a little bit about screws versus buttons. And I think one of the challenges of the congruent arc is you have a lot less surface area to put screws in. Are you experimenting with any buttons? And it came up, that was an area of discrepancy in the consensus as well, screws versus buttons and what the optimal was. And what's your take on that? And also between classic and congruent arc, what that factors in?
Yeah, so I think overall, especially for the younger residents and younger attendings listening to this, the key thing is whatever you decide to do, the first thing is that you want to be comfortable doing it and skilled at it. And whether that takes practice to do it and test the technique, sometimes if you can do the traditional technique as opposed to the congruent arc and you're more comfortable with that, that's what you should do for the most part, I think, especially with the data supporting both. The congruent heart, I think personally, that thinner bone, and we know some of these, you know, coracoids can be quite thin, and then you're shooting a screw through that. I think that's where you lead to the risk of fracture. I like the congruent arc technique in the sense that you can try on the inner aspect of it to restore the capsule label, and make the graft almost extra articular. There is some work where you can do that also with the traditional European ladder J. But just like Owen said, I believe you can get better compression on a larger surface area for potential healing. And for me, that's what it's all about. It's about getting healing of this graft. And I think there's just more surface area where you have the traditional European technique to basically reconstitute that anterior glenoid. But whatever you're comfortable with, I think is the key too. And in the case of doing the congruent arc, I think there's a little more skill that's required in terms of getting that proper centering point on that thinner piece of coracoid. In terms of buttons versus screws, I think the controversy comes in, can you get solid fixation with buttons and what's the lever arm? We know that the lever arm for the button technique, where you're fixated with buttons on both sides, the lever arm is the suture, right? And that moment arm and that micro motion is going to be a lot greater with that, you know, technique. I think as we improve the technology in those where the buttons and the motion between that and the biomechanics come close to screw fixation at time zero, I think that's that's the key, to figure out that technique. For me, the button technique, I'm utilizing it when I do an arthroscopic DTA technique. I think for me, it makes the technique easier for me. I've not had any issues with healing yet, but for it's always concerns me. But because I can do it better with the button technique and it's easier, that's why I've sort of transitioned, you know, to that. But I think it's something that we need to look at. And I'm not quite ready to do on an open procedure a button technique. If it's open and I'm looking straight at it, I'm putting a screw and getting solid fixation to make sure I don't have issues with healing afterwards.
Yeah, I think good points there in terms of doing what you're comfortable with. I think I still like doing screws, but I think like the consensus still lean more towards screws, but the buttons are starting to get some interest. So, and then you mentioned a little bit about the DTAs, and that kind of segues nicely into the next topic is bone grafting. You know, DTAs, like how do you design that? Does a sling effect factor in for the ladder J? And how are you deciding when to bone graft? You mentioned a little bit about size, and then also which bone graft? Is it DTA? Should we do autograft? And it seemed in the consensus that the main consensus was that it should be up to the surgeon, because there was no real consensus on exactly for that. But what's your take on that, Dr. Azuari?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And for me, I'm fortunate to be at a major academic institution with access to distal tibial allograft. I think that's an ideal graft, both in terms of bony reconstitution, the ability to get cartilage in there, as the size of these lesions where they're involving a significant portion of the glenoid, you're losing cartilage there. And I think when you put in a fresh piece of cartilage in there, you're reconstituting that. And I think that's critical. So for me, that is an excellent, graft option. Now, the utilization of iliac crest bone graft and things like that, I think they're acceptable. But for me, when you get to those larger bone defects, that's where I want to put an intra-articular graft with cartilage on that. The idea of using an enin-hibinet where you're attempting to putting the graft extra-articular, I think is certainly an option. And some people don't have access to distal tibial graft. But I think if you have access to it, distal tibial graft is an easy graft to work with. It's contoured almost perfectly when you get it, when you work with it. It's easy to contour it and shape it towards the anterior glenoid. And it almost looks like God put it there perfectly for us to utilize as a graft source. So for me, that's my go-to.
Yeah, I think you brought up your point about cost. Are you using fresh frozen or frozen? I think some of Dr. Ivan Wong's work said that frozen may be useful, may help bring down that cost a little bit. But which one are you using?
I mean, I have access to fresh, so I'm going with that. There have been cases from my partners who have used frozen. And I think when you look at it from that standpoint, you're reconstituting the bone in those cases. And I think we know that any way we reconstitute the bone at the anterior aspect of the shoulder is good, in the sense of that plays a critical role in recurrent instability. So one of my partners does it with frozen. And he fashions it such that he'll try to make it extra articular, which again, if you want to, again, believe that adds to less of a degree of arthrosis later on by making those bone grafts extra articular, I think that's debatable. But if I have access to fresh cartilage, I'm putting in fresh cartilage in the shoulder, because I'm using DTA for much larger lesions that are, 25, maybe probably more closer to 30% and above, where I think that's where you're really getting glenoid cartilage involved.
Right. And so you're keeping it intra-articular because you're doing on these much bigger lesions that you feel like needs to restore some cartilage.
Yes.
Yeah. Good points. And then, one other thing that always comes up and kind of segue a little bit into the next topic, which is return to play, is when you do a bone block procedure, whether that's ladder J or DTA or any other bone graft, are you getting CTs? Are you checking reabsorption? Are you using that to help you recover?
Right.
Or do you feel like it's not as you're always going to have some gap in there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So for the for the athlete that needs to get back within that 4 to 6 month mark, absolutely. So I'm approaching it, getting a CT to confirm that it's healed to allow them to go back to work, to contact sport. For the traditional patient that we see in the office that is not in a rush to necessarily get back to anything, I'll use traditional imaging, x-rays, and decide on that for them. They've gone through a lot with their shoulder. They're not itching to get back to any type of contact sport for more closer to 8 months to a year. So I typically don't have issues with them and will track them with x-rays at the 6 to 8 month mark to confirm certainly healing before saying, hey, you're good to go back. But it's really for those athletes who need to get back, desire to get back, the younger patient who has a sport that's coming up, that I'll just double check that we've got significant healing on the bone before letting them go back to play.
Does that mean you want to see 100% bony healing, or is there a degree that you're looking for, or just make sure there's some bridging callus there?
Yeah, for me, it's bridging callus, significant over whether you quantify it or not. For me, it's about 80%. And I'm not worried about the other 20%. I'll let them, especially at the 4 to 6 month mark, if I see that much healing, I'm confident, especially with screw fixation, to let them go back.
That's good. And then kind of a little bit more into kind of return to play. And these I'm going to ask you about them, because I think one of the things that was really unique to this consensus that was different than other talks about return to play was that you tried to define what failure actually was. And I don't know if there's ever been a study that had that many people trying to define what failure was. And what's your takeaway from it? And how should we be defining failure as a group and from the consensus?
Yeah, I think it's the interesting thing in this, and kind of one of the backgrounds why this came up, is sometimes, you know, patients, when we looked at our 5-year bank card outcomes, the biggest predictor of athletes being happy was, were they able to get back to sport? So we often talk about failure just in terms of, is it recurrence? But I mean, these patients can be apprehensive, painful, and it's trying to say, like, what factors actually go into that? What should we be considering to say, like, a successful procedure, you know, or even other complications? You know, if they have a ladder chain, there's a subscap failure, going back to do something there, you know, maybe considered a failure of the treatment. So I was trying to define that more closely. I mean, even with return to play, saying, you know, they return to play, it's like, that's great, but did they return to play without re-injuring? And it's just saying, like, trying to define better, like, are we getting back the patients back to everything they wanted out of the surgery?
Yeah. And so when we think about failure, obviously the main thing is, can they get back to sport, as you mentioned, their activities? And that's just, what are you guys doing at NYU in terms of return to play testing? And one of the things that came up, the consensus, was psychological factors. And you know, is that part of any kind of battery you're doing there at NYU? How are you guys doing it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And certainly for lower extremity, I think we're well tapped into this with return to play for ACL reconstructions and things like that. For upper extremity shoulder and return to play, I think we have, for our parameters, unfortunately, even at a major institution, are pretty archaic in the sense that they've gone through their physical therapy. They're at least 6 to 8 months out. They don't feel any anterior apprehension. And if they've had a bony procedure, they've had some imaging that confirms some significant healing. You know, I'm not sure that that's good enough. You know, we don't do any type of muscle testing or anything like that. And I'm not sure whether in the shoulder that's going to play as major a role as we know it, as it does in the knee. Probably makes sense that it does. And I think this is certainly an area that's ripe for more research into it, that there are other factors other than the healing of the tissue, i.e. ACL when it heals. That's not the only factor. We know that muscular control and achieving a certain muscular strength compared to the contralateral extremity is important. So unfortunately, Brian, we don't have as sophisticated a testing scheme other than what I just described to get patients back with after upper extremity surgery. I don't know. Do you have anything at Duke that you're doing that adds a little to this?
Yeah, we are. We're building a battery that we have that we're looking at strength. We're looking at endurance, fatigability. We're looking at performance testing on force plates, looking at the rate of firing of the muscles, and as well as the total amount of strength. And we're still kind of in the first 8 months of getting the pilot data on that. But that, and on top of that, we're also looking at psychological factors, so the shoulder and stability return sport at RSI. And as well as we'll see scores and everything that comes with that battery. And so, you know, day to come, you know, there's, you know, I was going to ask Owen too, because I know he's done a systematic review recently on the return to play shoulder instability. And your take from that systematic review, adding to itself from the consensus here, like what do you find are things that we should be incorporating and considering?
I mean, I think mainly, you know, patient factors. I think the big thing is moving beyond just time-based points of return and saying that, you know, an athlete can go back at 4 months and this is when they're cleared. I think it really is individual. It's looking at how they do compared to that contralateral side. And there really isn't that same level of evidence that we have in the ACL, which has really been well borne out. But I mean, the good thing about studying shoulder instability is you can just take an ACL concept and try and look at it, because an unstable joint seems to have similar concepts, you know. And I think that's kind of the next area and what we're looking at in Duke. But I really think the big thing is just saying beyond time-based return, what patient factors, you know, there is a big difference between someone who has a soft tissue procedure, a bony procedure, how long they need to be immobilized and getting their strength back. And I think making sure they're confident enough to go back, because, I mean, again, we know from the ACL that if they're more apprehensive, they might, you know, stop suddenly or even kind of just second guess themselves before doing actions. And people with lower RSI scores in the knee have higher failure rates. And I think that, you know, there may be something there, but it's something we really need to look at more closely.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot to be taken up. We know that with the knee, and as well as some early studies with the shoulder, the Pittsburgh group, that just the fact of doing testing decreases the rate, you know, just having to jump some objectives to look at. So definitely an area to grow, and I think there'll be more to come with that. But I wanted to thank both Dr. Jansbury and Dr. Hurley for their time, you know, for these two, for this, you know, series of podcasts, and sharing your experience with this consensus and your thoughts on shoulder instability, and hitting basically the full gamut of, you know, history, physical, imaging, arthroscopic procedures, bone procedures, and all that, and return to play. And so I appreciate you guys taking the time. And thanks to the audience. So, you know, so these articles can be found in Arthroscopy Journal online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. Thanks for joining us. And thanks again, Dr. Azari and Dr. Hurley, for your time.